Listen to the land, it has a story for you, about people and their dreams and how they made them come true. Listen to the land, listen to the land.
As you drive around the north edge of Lincoln on the interstate, you'll notice that the city sits in a natural bowl. On the west edge of the city, the interstate descends into the bowl, and at this point, you cross an area known to the pioneers as the Salt Basin. Pioneers, and the Indians before them, came from great distances to gather salt here. And we must not forget how important salt was to these people. After all, they had no refrigerators, and they preserved meat only by salting it. The salt bed seemed an important natural resource to the first inhabitants of Lincoln, as in the early 1870s, Texas cattle were being trailed just west of the city, heading for the Union Pacific shipping pens at Schuyler. Some men in Lincoln had a brilliant idea. Why not bring the cattle to Lincoln, slaughter them, and salt, and pack the meat right here in one spot? Unfortunately, farmers in southern Nebraska shut off the Texas trail. They didn't like the longhorns trampling their crops and spreading disease. And Lincoln's dream of becoming a meatpacking center collapsed. But the folks in Lincoln weren't downhearted for long. They had other things to scheme about and to cheer about, especially the coming of the railroad to Lincoln. In a very real sense, the story of Pioneer Nebraska is the story of railroads. All over the state, dusty wagon tracks were replaced by shining steel ribbons. All over Nebraska, the pioneers heard the songs of the Irish workers as they laid the tracks.
Every morning at 7 o'clock, 20 terriers are working on the rock. The boss comes along and he says, keep still, and come down heavy with your cast iron drill. Drill ye terriers, drill. Drill ye terriers, drill. It's work all day for the sugar in your tay, down behind the railway, and drill ye terriers, drill. Our new boss was Bill McCann. By gosh, he was a blame mean man. One day a premature blast went off, and a mile in the air went Big Jim Goff. Drill ye terriers, drill. Drill ye terriers, drill. It's work all day for the sugar in your tay, down behind the railway, and drill ye terriers, drill. Next time payday came around, Jim Goff a dollar short was found. When asked what for, came this reply, you're docked for the time you were up in the sky. Drill ye terriers, drill. Drill ye terriers.
Like the capital of any frontier state, Lincoln was an exciting place to live. The political pot constantly bubbled in Pioneer Nebraska. Countless men came to Nebraska expressly for the purpose of getting in on the ground floor of politics. A few days after landing in Nebraska, they began to give speeches and to run for office. Nobody with political ambition wasted much time. Geography at first influenced politics in Nebraska. The people who lived north of the Platte River hardly talked to those who lived south of the river. The territorial capital had been established at Omaha, which pleased the North Platters and infuriated the South Platters. Most legislative actions appeared to benefit North Platte. At least, this is what the South Platters charged. And in the 1850s, frustrated South Platters met in a convention and voted to secede from Nebraska and join Kansas. But no luck here either, for Kansas turned them down cold. There was only one thing for the South Platters to do, dig in and fight. And politics got red hot. In 1864, George Miller of Omaha, prominent editor and politician, decided to run for the post of territorial delegate to Congress. Never one to duck a fight, Miller crossed the Platte River and campaigned in hostile territory. His experiences in the South Platte District have a distinctly modern ring, because in Nebraska City, his opponents organized a riot to break up his meeting. In one town, he slept in a house guarded by friends armed with shotguns. He'd been warned that if he ever came to this town, he'd never leave alive. A mob greeted him in Brownville, and he was lucky to get away with his skin. At Pawnee City, no one would rent him a hall. And throughout the South Platte District, his supporters told him that they'd been threatened with personal injury or destruction of their property if they dared vote for him. The climax of the feud between North and South Platte came when Nebraska entered the Union. A decision had to be made about the location of the state capital. And By this time, the South Platters substantially outnumbered their foes across the river. So the South Platte representatives voted to take the capital from Omaha and give it to a town in South Platte. As a last nasty gesture, the North Platters insisted that the new capital be named Lincoln. They didn't think self-respecting Democrats would vote for a capital named after the leader of the opposition party. But they misjudged the mood of the South Platters. The capital was moved to a spot on the edge of the Salt Basin, and it was named Lincoln. In pioneer days, as now, political quarrels dominated the newspaper headlines. But the people were interested in many other things. In Nebraska, great interest was given to developing the frontier state, to attracting settlers and building a foundation for a prosperous society. And the homestead law seemed to be the very key to the process. To many Nebraskans, this law seemed to be the most important piece of legislation ever passed by Congress. The millions of persons struggling just to stay alive back east in the crowded cities now could come west, obtain 160 acres of land free, and live happily ever after. The law touched something very deep in human nature, the belief that farmers are the backbone of a democratic society, the conviction that people who own and work the land are the most desirable citizens. Now, whether these ideas are true or false is unimportant. The point is, thousands poured into Nebraska seeking lands to homestead. They came to secure a promise of a better life, and where except along the frontier could this expectation be fulfilled? As long as there was a frontier, Americans could be optimistic. No matter what happened to a person, there was always the opportunity to go to the frontier and start again. But we should not forget how quickly the optimism faded. By the late 1880s, Nebraska's leaders warned that the frontier was vanishing. Free land was rapidly disappearing. But prairie pioneers had no time to worry about the distant future. Immediate goals had to be met. Homes built, sod plowed, crops planted. Settlers by the thousands poured onto the land. Some of them, men who had gone west to the gold fields, who had become discouraged, decided to return to the Nebraska prairies and take up farming.
For each man who got rich from mining, perceiving that hundreds grow poor, I made up my mind to try farming, the only pursuit that is sure. The only pursuit that is sure. The only pursuit that is sure. I made up my mind to try farming, the only pursuit that is sure. I tried to get out of this country, but poverty forced me to stay. Until I became an old settler, now nothing can drive me away. Now nothing can drive me away. No, nothing can drive me away. Until I became an old settler, now nothing can drive me away.
While the farmers turned over the rich prairie soil and planted their first crop of corn, other men were busy in other ways. There were those, for example, who were busy building the towns. Look at it this way. Some pioneers planted corn, other pioneers planted towns. These were not separate activities. They were both part of the process of developing Nebraska. Now, you can be sure the towns didn't just pop up out of the ground. Much work was involved in starting a community, and towns didn't grow up by accident. Take the community of Milford, which is 24 miles west of Lincoln. This town appeared on the banks of the Blue River for two reasons, and you find the reasons in its name. There was a ford across the river at this point, and some men had built a mill to grind grain. Hence, Mill Ford. Seward, to the northwest of Milford, represented a second kind of community. It was the fruit of one man's efforts, a man by the name of Lewis Moffat, who owned the land where the town was laid out. A third type of town was the kind developed and promoted by a town company. Men would band together, pool their resources, buy a town site, stake out lots, and hope that people would come to settle. This is how the town of Goner, to the west of Seward, was born, and it was the same with Aurora, farther west. This town was dreamed up by a group of men back in Illinois who sent one of their number to find a place to plant a town on the Nebraska prairie. Very often, towns grew up as centers for particular groups of settlers. In northeastern Seward County is the town of Garland, originally named Germantown, because it was in the middle of an extensive German community. Henderson, west of York, is another case in point. This town ultimately became the center of a colony of German-Russian Mennonites who came to Nebraska in the 1870s. The railroads had a great deal to do with the Mennonites coming here. Both the Union Pacific and the Burlington Railroad sent agents to Europe to advertise and promote Nebraska lands. They wanted the foreigners to purchase lands owned by the railroads or just to settle along their railroads. After all, they had to have some customers. The German Russians were prime customers. They came in large colonies, they were excellent farmers, and usually they had money with which to purchase land. The railroads competed like mad for them. And unfortunately, the Nebraska lines usually came in second. Most of the Mennonites went to Kansas, but a few groups were persuaded to settle in Nebraska. Henderson remains today a predominantly Mennonite community. Its most outstanding landmark is its huge, beautiful church. But in addition, it is one of the neatest and cleanest communities I know of in Nebraska. You might want to drive a few miles off the interstate and see this interesting town. Sometimes, of course, things didn't work out for the town builders. In the 1850s, the town of Camden was founded in the southern part of Seward County. It was on the Freighters Trail, which ran from Nebraska City to Fort Kearney. By 1867, it could boast a hotel, a blacksmith shop, and several stores. Camden made a bid for the state capital, and its citizens dreamed of their town becoming a railroad center. But none of these good things came to pass. Camden died, and today a cornfield covers the site of the forgotten town. You can see now that many different kinds of people were included in the ranks of the prairie pioneers. Some were eager fellows out for political office. Some were men who were restless after serving in the Civil War. Some were men whose forefathers had opened up other frontiers. Others were newly arrived immigrants, the Germans, the Scandinavians, or the Czechs. The Nebraska frontier was such a fascinating place because it had all of these types. The pioneers built the towns, opened their farms, and they all shared in the experience of the prairie pioneers, an experience which made them all Americans.
Beautiful Nebraska, peaceful prairie land, laced with many rivers and the hills of sand. Dark green valleys cradled in the earth, rain and sunshine bring abundant birth. Beautiful Nebraska, as you look around, you will find your rainbow reaching to the ground. All these wonders by the master's hand, beautiful Nebraska land. We are so proud of the state where we live. There is no place that has so much to give. Beautiful Nebraska, as you look around, you will find your rainbow reaching to the ground. All these wonders by the master's hand, beautiful Nebraska land. Beautiful Nebraska land. Listen to the land, it has a story for you, about people and their dreams and how they made them come true. Listen to the land, listen to the land.
As we approach Grand Island, let's pause for a moment because I want to emphasize one important point, namely that history happens all around us. And that one city, such as Grand Island, has a tremendous story to tell. To illustrate, let's examine the themes which we can associate with this city. One, Grand Island, the huge island in the Platte River from which the city takes its name, was named by French traders. Two, Grand Island lies on one of the major western trails, the trail which led west from Omaha on the north side of the Platte River, a trail used by Mormons, freighters, emigrants, and soldiers. 3, although founded in the early 1850s, the settlement of Grand Island didn't show much life until a group of Germans arrived to take up residence. Now, this almost ended the town, too, because in 1859, a passing gold seeker who didn't like Germans set fire to the dry prairie and nearly burned the town down. 4, Grand Island experienced tremendous Indian difficulties. In the 1860s, fortifications were erected near the town to protect the terrified citizens. Many settlers were killed and wounded by Indians in this vicinity, and southwest of Grand Island is a place where the two Martin brothers, trying to flee from Indians, were pinned together by an arrow and left for dead on the prairie. 5, Grand Island is a railroad town. The construction of the Union Pacific down the Platte Valley made this community into an important trade and shipping point. And 6, when I come to Grand Island, I think not only of the fur traders, the Mormons, the railroad builders, and the Indians. I think especially about the people who homesteaded this valley. So now, let's talk about these homesteaders. The idea behind the homestead law was to give land to any person who seriously wanted a farm of his own. Unfortunately, the law didn't work out the way it was intended, at least not all of the time. Maybe if we imagine for a moment you are a homesteader. You come to Grand Island on a Union Pacific train, determined to find a homestead, settle down, and begin farming. You're not prepared for the shock you get when you start to look for land, because you find that good land available for homesteading is very, very hard to find. It's not that the land is filled. This is what is so discouraging. There aren't many settlers around at all. Why can't you take any vacant piece of land for your homestead? First, because roughly half of the land in the valley is owned by the Union Pacific Railroad. Remember, Congress gave the Union Pacific a huge land grant consisting of every other section of land on either side of the tracks. The land was to be sold to pay construction costs. So if you want some of this land, you must buy it from the railroad. In addition, the federal government gave huge tracts of land to the state of Nebraska, and undoubtedly some of the remaining land in the valley belongs to the state. And again, you have to buy it. So many of the first homesteaders had to settle on poor pieces of land located far from the railroad and the fertile Platte Valley. Then there's a second obstacle. You need money to develop your homestead. Those who came without funds didn't have much of a chance. In later years, many homesteaders claimed they'd been tricked into coming to Nebraska, and it's easy to understand why they felt that way. But the settlers did receive some warning. In January 1882, for example, an Easterner wrote to the editor of the Lincoln newspaper and asked about homesteading in Nebraska. The editor provided some honest answers. First of all, he said, the homesteader would have a tough time finding good land. The land available under the homestead law would be considerable distant from the railroad. He said the homesteader would have a hard time locating timber and fuel, and he would have to build his first home out of prairie sod, Nebraska marble as it was called. You would have to dig a deep well by hand to get a water supply, and breaking the sod was hard work too. So the editor offered this advice: don't come to Nebraska unless you have an adequate supply of money, a good team of work animals, and a willingness to work hard. To put it bluntly, the homesteader had to take risks. After you paid your $15 filing fee to the government, you were required to live on the land for 5 years. After that, it was yours. The homesteaders joked about the arrangement. They said that the government was willing to bet you $15 to 160 acres of land that you'd starve to death in 5 years.
Tom Hyde is my name, an old bachelor I am. You'll find me out west in the land of fame. You'll find me out west on an elegant plane, starving to death on my government claim. So hurrah for Hall County, the land of the free, the land of the bedbug, grasshopper, and flea. I'll sing of its praises, tell of its fame, while starving to death on my government claim. How happy am I when I crawl into bed, a rattlesnake hisses a tune at my head. A gay little centipede, all without fear, crawls over my pillow and into my ear. So goodbye to Hall County, where blizzards arise. The sun never sinks, and a flea never dies. The wind never ceases, but always remains, till it starves us all off of our government claims.
For many homesteaders, life was indeed a grim joke. Some were starved out, others chased out by the Indians. For those who hung on, the biggest problem was just staying alive. The sod house helped because a family had to have shelter, and a soddy was cheap and easy to build. For thousands of pioneer Nebraskans, the sod house was home, and to them it symbolized their lives on the prairie.
I am looking rather seedy now while living on my claim, and my victuals are not always served the best. And the mice play shyly round me as I settle down to rest in my little old sod shanty on my claim. Oh, the hinges are of leather and the windows have the glass, and the board roof lets the howling blizzard in. But I'm happy as a clam here on the land of Uncle Sam in my little old sod shanty on my claim. When I left my eastern home, a bachelor so gay, to try to win my way to wealth and fame, whoever thought I'd come down to burning twisted hay in my little old sod shanty on my claim? Oh, the hinges are of leather.
While the soddies were usually warm in winter and cool in summer, they did have some drawbacks. The roof almost always leaked, and rattlesnakes and bugs liked to live in the cracks in the walls. One homesteader made up a song which he and his family often sang.
We're in the land of bugs and fleas, and golly, don't they go for me. They bite my back, bite my breast, they won't give me a minute's rest. Ho, 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 don't you know, I am telling what is so. Ho, 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 don't you know, I am telling what is so. When immigration first comes in, think this country's settled thin. But when the fleas around them stick, they begin to think it's settled thick. Oh, ho, ho, don't you know, I am telling what is so. Oh, ho, ho, don't you know, I am telling what is so. I've scratched myself till I am sore, and still I scratch the more and more. And now my song is almost sung, a great big flea his work's begun. Ho, 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 don't you know, I am telling what is so. Oh, ho, ho, don't you know, I am telling what is so.
Humorous though they are, the songs of the pioneers tell us much about the problems of life on the prairie. Life was really grim, especially when it didn't rain, and crops died in the fields, and grasshoppers descended in clouds from the blazing sky. This is what happened in the 1870s. Pioneer histories are filled with stories about grasshoppers, about the day the western sky was covered with dark clouds and blotted out the sun. And the clouds turned out to be millions of grasshoppers which fell upon the land and left nothing but a ravaged land behind them. West of Grand Island, in the vicinity of Gibbon, a large number of men, many of them Army veterans, came to settle in the early 1870s. The drought and the grasshoppers just about wiped them out, and the settlers became desperate. They knew they could not survive without outside help. In our day, we know that the government would take steps to help, but in the 1870s, the idea of government aid for disaster victims was something new. But the disaster was so great, something had to be done to help the people. Finally, orders came from Washington for Army officers to distribute surplus Army clothes and food to the settlers. Lieutenant Theodore True was one of the officers sent to Nebraska to supervise the distribution of the relief supplies, and he kept a diary of his experiences in Dawson County.
February 2nd, 1875. A snowy night was succeeded this morning by a blinding storm from the northeast. Finding it was impossible to go to Wood River today, I called upon the county officers and obtained from them a list of the names of persons who were the most needy. I then called upon these families and ascertained their conditions. It was pitiable in most instances upon entering the poor hut to see the women and children crouched, shivering around their dull fires in the midst of a cloud of pulverized snow driven in upon them by the storm. Money is very scarce. the poorer people esteem themselves fortunate that they can find labor enough to supply their families with food. February 4, 1875. This morning, the mercury marked minus 30 degrees. At 11 o'clock, I started for the Wood River settlement. February 5, 1875. The settlement of Wood River is quite a new one. It is, for the most part, composed of ex-volunteers of the Union Army who have brought with them their families and settled upon soldiers' homesteads. The attempts at agriculture have resulted almost uniformly in failure owing to the ravages of the grasshoppers. Nobody has anything to buy with, and accordingly, the worn-out clothing of the settlers had not been replaced by new.
Since there never was enough Army food and clothing to go around, many Nebraskans appealed to people in the East for help. Mrs. Wooster lived just east of Grand Island with her husband and child. They'd worked hard to develop their claim, and then the grasshoppers came. Here are some lines from a letter she wrote to the pastor of a church in Brooklyn, New York. The date is April 8, 1875.
Dear sir, after the perusal of this, do you deem it proper? Will you please place it in the hand of some kind Christian lady of your congregation? Feeling assured that there may be a lady that, did they know the half that I suffer in my loneliness in this treeless, destitute grasshopper country, they would gladly lend me a little aid by the way of sending me some of their thrown-aside clothing. Any article of dress for myself or little girl, 1 year old, would be very meekly received. Did I not feel almost driven to insanity by this loneliness and destitution, I could not write this, although I do feel it committing a sin. We have lived in this country 3 years, and during this time I have had only 3 calico dresses, and the calico that reaches us is so homely that with no little bright neckties to enliven it, it becomes one very uncouth. A few yards of muslin, 1 pair of shoes, not a glove, hat or cloak, shawl or anything but the same ones I wore here from the East. My little baby has had nothing but little calico dresses all this long, cold winter.
This is what the land tells us as we travel the Great Platte Valley. Today we see prosperous farms and thriving towns, but a price was paid for all of this. The suffering of thousands who fought Indians, endured droughts, watched the grasshoppers descend upon their fields. Discouraged and dismayed, many pulled out, but the real story of Nebraska is the story of those who stayed. Listen to the land, for it tells us the story of heroes and heroines who faced the worst the prairie offered, yet never lost their faith nor their sense of humor.
We've reached the land of desert sweet, where nothing grows for man to eat. The wind does blow with blistering heat, o'er all the plains so hard to beat. Nebraska land, Nebraska land, as on thy desert soil I stand and gaze away across the plains, I wonder why it never rains till Gabriel blows his trumpet sound and says the rain has gone around.